the novelty of cooperation began to appeal to Carding. There was worthwhile power here, which could be bribed into usefulness for as long as it was necessary. Of course, afterwards, it might have to be discouraged. Spelter thought patronage. He'd heard the term used, though never within the university, and he knew it meant getting those above you to give you a leg up. Of course, no wizard would normally dream of giving a colleague a leg up unless it was in order to catch them on the hop. The mere thought of actually encouraging a competitor. But, on the other hand, this old fool might still be of assistance for a while, and afterwards, well... They looked at one another with mutual grudging admiration and unlimited mistrust. But at least it was a mistrust each one felt he could rely on, until afterwards. "His name is Coyne," said Spelter. "He says his father's name is Ipslaw." "I wonder how many brothers has he got," said Carding. "I'm sorry?" "There hasn't been magic like that in this university in centuries," said Carding. "Maybe for thousands of years. I've only ever read about it." "We banished an Ipslaw 30 years ago," said Spelter. "According to the records, he'd got married. I can see that if he had sons, they'd be wizards. But I don't understand how..." "That wasn't wizardry. That was sorcery," said Carding, leaning back in his chair. Spelter stared at him across the bubbling varnish. "Sorcery? The 8th son of a wizard would be a sorcerer." "I didn't know that." "It's not widely advertised." "Yes, but sorcerers were a long time ago. I mean, the magic was a lot stronger then. Men were different. It didn't have anything to do with, well, breeding." Spelter was thinking, 8 sons. That means he did it 8 times. At least. Gosh. "Sorcerers could do everything," he went on. "They were nearly as powerful as the gods. There was no end of trouble. The gods simply wouldn't allow that sort of thing anymore. Depend upon it." "Well, there was trouble because the sorcerers fought amongst themselves," said Carding. "But one sorcerer wouldn't be any trouble. One sorcerer... correctly advised, that is, by older and wiser minds. But he wants the Arch-Chancellor's hat. Why can't he have it?" Spelter's mouth dropped open. This was too much, even for him. Carding smiled at him amiably. "But the hat?" "It's just a symbol," said Carding. "It's nothing special. If he wants it, he can have it. It's a small enough thing, just a symbol, nothing more. A figure hat."
"A figure hat?"
"Worn by a figurehead."
"But the gods choose the Arch-Chancellor."
Carding raised an eyebrow.
"Do they?" he said, and coughed. "Well, yes, I suppose they do, in a manner of speaking."
"In a manner of speaking?"
Carding got up and gathered his skirts around him.
"I think," he said, "that you have a great deal to learn. By the way, where is that hat?"
"I don't know," said Spelter, who was still quite shaken. "Somewhere in, Virid's apartments, I suppose."
"We'd better fetch it," said Carding.
He paused in the doorway and stroked his beard reflectively.
"I remember Ipslaw," he said. "We were students together. Wild fellow, odd habits. Superb wizard, of course, before he went to the bad. He had a funny way of twitching his eyebrow, I remember, when he was excited."
Carding looked blankly across 40 years of memory and shivered.
"The hat," he reminded himself. "Let's find it. It would be a shame if anything happened to it."
In fact, the hat had no intention of letting anything happen to it, and was currently hurrying towards the mended drum under the arm of a rather puzzled black-clad thief. The thief, as will become apparent, was a special type of thief. The thief was an artist of theft. Other thieves merely stole everything that was not nailed down, but this thief stole the nails as well. This thief had scandalised Ankh by taking a particular interest in stealing, with astonishing success, things that were in fact not only nailed down, but also guarded by keen-eyed guards in inaccessible strongrooms. There are artists that will paint an entire chapel ceiling. This was the kind of thief that could steal it. This particular thief was credited with stealing the jewel's disembowelling knife from the temple of Ofla, the crocodile god, during the middle of evensong, and the silver shoes from the patrician's finest racehorse while it was in the process of winning a race. When Gritola Mimpsi, vice-president of the Thieves' Guild, was jostled in the marketplace, and then found on returning home that a freshly stolen handful of diamonds had vanished from their place of concealment, he knew who to blame. This was because Gritola had swallowed the jewels for safekeeping. This was the type of thief that could steal the initiative, the moment, and the words right out of your mouth. However, it was the first time it had stolen something that not only asked it to, in a low but authoritative voice, but gave precise and somehow unarguable instructions about how it was to be disposed of. It was that cusp of the night that marks the turning point of Ankh Morpork's busy day, when those who make their living under the sun are resting after their labours, and those who turn an honest dollar by the cold light of the moon are just getting up the energy to go to work. The day had in fact reached that gentle point when it was too late for housebreaking and too early for burglary. Rincewind sat alone in the crowded smoky room and didn't take much notice when a shadow passed over the table and a sinister figure sat down opposite him. There was nothing very remarkable about sinister figures in this place. The Drum jealously guarded its reputation as the most stylishly disreputable tavern in Ankh Morpork, and the big troll that now guarded the door carefully vetted customers for suitability in the way of black cloaks, glowing eyes, magic swords, and so forth. Rincewind never found out what he did to the failures. Perhaps he ate them. When the figure spoke, its husky voice came from the depths of a black velvet hood lined with fur. "Psst," it said. "Not very," said Rincewind, who was in a state of mind where he couldn't resist it. "But I'm working on it."
"I'm looking for a wizard," said the voice.
It sounded hoarse with the effort of disguising itself, but again this was nothing unusual in the Drum.
"Any wizard in particular?" Rincewind said guardedly.
People could get into trouble this way.
"One with a keen sense of tradition who would not mind taking risks for high reward,"
said another voice. It appeared to be coming from a round black leather box under the stranger's arm.
"Ah," said Rincewind, "that, narrows it down a bit, then. Does this involve a perilous journey into unknown and probably dangerous lands?"
"It does, as a matter of fact."
"Encounters with exotic creatures?" Rincewind smiled.
"Could be."
"Almost certain death?"
"Almost certainly."
Rincewind nodded and picked up his hat.
"Well, I wish you every success in your search," he said. "I'd help you myself, only I'm not going to."
"What?"
"Sorry, I don't know why, but the prospect of certain death in unknown lands at the claws of exotic monsters isn't for me. I've tried it, and I couldn't get the hang of it. Each to their own, that's what I say, and I was cut out for boredom."
He rammed his hat on his head and stood up a little unsteadily. He'd reached the foot of the steps leading up into the street when a voice behind him said,
"A real wizard would have accepted."
He could have kept going. He could have walked up the stairs, out onto the street, got a pizza at the Clatchian Takeaway in Snig's Alley, and gone to bed. History would have been totally changed, and in fact would also have been considerably shorter. But he would have got a good night's sleep, although, of course, it would have been on the floor. The future held its breath, waiting for Rincewind to walk away. He didn't do this for three reasons. One was alcohol. One was the tiny flame of pride that flickers in the heart of even the most careful coward. But the third was the voice. It was beautiful. It sounded like wild silk looks. The subject of wizards and sex is a complicated one, but as has already been indicated, it does in essence boil down to this. When it comes to wine, women and song, wizards are allowed to get drunk and croon as much as they like. The reason given to young wizards was that the practice of magic is hard and demanding and incompatible with sticky and furtive activities. It was a lot more sensible, they were told, to stop worrying about that sort of thing and really get to grips with Wadderley's occult primer instead. Funnily enough, this didn't seem to satisfy, and young wizards suspected that the real reason was that the rules were made by old wizards, with poor memories. They were quite wrong, although the real reason had long been forgotten. If wizards were allowed to go around breeding all the time, there was a risk of sorcery. Of course, Rincewind had been around a bit, and had seen a thing or two, and had thrown off his early training to such an extent that he was quite capable of spending hours at a time in a woman's company without having to go off for a cold shower and lie down. But that voice would have made even a statue get down off its pedestal for a few brisk laps of the playing field and 50 press-ups. It was a voice that could make "good morning" sound like an invitation to bed. The stranger threw back her hood and shook out her long hair. It was almost pure white. Since her skin was tanned golden, the general effect was calculated to hit the male libido like a lead pipe. Rincewind hesitated, and lost a splendid opportunity to keep quiet. From the top of the stairs came a thick, trollish voice.
"Here! I said you can't go through there!"
She sprang forward and shoved a round leather box into Rincewind's arms.
"Quick, you must come with me," she said. "You are in great danger."
"Why?"
"Because I will kill you if you don't."
"Yes, but hang on a minute. In that case," Rincewind protested feebly. Three members of the Patrician's personal guard appeared at the top of the stairs. Their leader beamed down at the room. The smile suggested he intended to be the only one to enjoy the joke.
"Don't nobody move," he suggested.
Rincewind heard a clatter behind him as more guards appeared in the back door. The drum's other customers paused with their hands on assorted hilts. These weren't the normal city watch, cautious and genially corrupt. These were walking slabs of muscle, and they were absolutely unbribable, if only because the patrician could outbid anyone else. Anyway, they didn't seem to be looking for anyone except the woman. The rest of the clientele relaxed and prepared to enjoy the show. Eventually, it might be worth joining it, once it was certain which was the winning side. Rincewind felt the pressure tighten on his wrist.
"Are you mad?" he hissed. "This is messing with the man!"
There was a swish, and the sergeant's shoulder suddenly sprouted a knife hilt. Then the girl spun around and with surgical precision planted a small foot in the groin of the first guard through the door. 20 pairs of eyes watered in sympathy. Rincewind grabbed his hat and tried to dive under the nearest table, but that grip was steel. The next guard to approach got another knife in the thigh. Then she drew a sword like a very long needle and raised it threateningly.
"Anyone else?" she said.
One of the guards raised a crossbow. The librarian, sitting hunched over his drink, reached out a lazy arm like two broom handles strung with elastic and slapped him backwards. The bolt rebounded from the star on Rincewind's hat and hit the wall by a respected procurer who was sitting two tables away. His bodyguards threw another knife, which just missed a thief across the room, who picked up a bench and hit two guards, who struck out at the nearest drinkers. After that, one thing sort of led to another, and pretty soon everyone was fighting to get something, either away, out, or even. Rincewind found himself pulled relentlessly behind the bar. The landlord was sitting on his moneybags under the counter with two machetes crossed on his knees, enjoying a quiet drink. Occasionally the sound of breaking furniture would make him wince. The last thing Rincewind saw before he was dragged away was the librarian. Despite looking like a hairy rubber sack full of water, the orangutan had the weight and reach of any man in the room and was currently sitting on a guard's shoulders and trying with reasonable success to unscrew his head. Of more concern to Rincewind was the fact that he was being dragged upstairs.
"My dear lady," he said desperately, "what do you have in mind?"
"Is there a way onto the roof?"
"Yes. What's in this box?"
"Shh!"
She halted at a bend in the dingy corridor, reached into a belt pouch, and scattered a handful of small metal objects on the floor behind them. Each one was made of four nails welded together, so that however the things fell, one was always pointing upwards. She looked critically at the nearest doorway.
"You haven't got about 4 feet of cheese wire on you, have you?" she said wistfully.
She'd drawn another throwing knife and was throwing it up and catching it again.
"I don't think so," said Rincewind weakly.
"Pity, I've run out. Okay, come on."
"Why? I haven't done anything."
She went to the nearest window, pushed open the shutters, and paused with one leg over the sill.
"Fine," she said over her shoulder. "Stay here and explain it to the guards."
"Why are they chasing you?"
"I don't know."
"Oh, come on, there must be a reason."
"Oh, there's plenty of reasons. I just don't know which one. Are you coming?"
Rincewind hesitated. The Patrician's personal guard was not known for its responsive approach to community policing, preferring to cut bits off instead. Among the things they took a dim view of was, well, basically, people being in the same universe. Running away from them was likely to be a capital offence.
"I think maybe I'll come along with you," he said gallantly. "A girl can come to harm all alone in this city."
Freezing fog filled the streets of Ankh-Morpork. The flares of street traders made little yellow halos in the smothering billows. The girl peered around a corner.
"We've lost them," she said. "Stop shaking. You're safe now."
"What, you mean I'm all alone with a female homicidal maniac?" said Rincewind. "Fine." She relaxed and laughed at him.
"I was watching you," she said. "An hour ago you were afraid that your future was going to be dull and uninteresting."
"I want it to be dull and uninteresting," said Rincewind bitterly. "I'm afraid it's going to be short."
"Turn your back," she commanded, stepping into an alley.
"Not on your life," he said.
"I'm going to take my clothes off."
Rincewind spun around, his face red. There was a rustling behind him and a waft of scent. After a while, she said,
"You can look round now."
He didn't.
"You needn't worry. I've put some more on."
He opened his eyes. The girl was wearing a demure white lace dress with fetchingly puffed sleeves. He opened his mouth. He realized with absolute clarity that up to now the trouble he had been in was simple, modest, and nothing he couldn't talk his way out of, given a decent chance, or, failing that, a running start. His brain started to send urgent messages to his sprinting muscles. But before they could get through, she'd grabbed his arm again.
"You really shouldn't be so nervous," she said sweetly. "Now, let's have a look at this thing."
She pulled the lid off the round box in Rincewind's unprotesting hands and lifted out the Arch-Chancellor's hat. The octarines around its crown blazed in all eight colours of the spectrum, creating the kind of effects in the foggy alley that it would take a very clever special effects director and a whole battery of star filters to achieve by any non-magical means. As she raised it high in the air, it created its own nebula of colours that very few people ever see in legal circumstances. Rincewind sank gently to his knees. She looked down at him, puzzled.
"Legs given out?"
It's the hat. The Arch-Chancellor's hat," said Rincewind hoarsely. His eyes narrowed. "You've stolen it," he shouted, struggling back to his feet and grabbing for the sparkling brim.
"It's just a hat."
"Give it to me this minute. Women mustn't touch it. It belongs to wizards."
"Why are you getting so worked up?" she said.
Rincewind opened his mouth. Rincewind closed his mouth. He wanted to say, "It's the Arch-Chancellor's hat, don't you understand? It's worn by the head of all wizards. Well, on the head of all wizards. No, metaphorically, it's worn by all wizards. Potentially, anyway. And it's what every wizard aspires to. It's the symbol of organized magic. It's the pointy tip of the profession. It's a symbol. It's what it means to all wizards." And so on. Rincewind had been told about the hat on his first day at university, and it had sunk into his impressionable mind like a lead weight into a jelly. He wasn't sure of much in the world, but he was certain that the Arch-Chancellor's hat was important. Maybe even wizards need a little magic in their lives.
"Rincewind," said the hat.
He stared at the girl.
"It spoke to me."
"Like a voice in your head?"
"Yes. It did that to me, too. But it knew my name."
"Of course we do, stupid fellow. We are supposed to be a magic hat, after all."
The hat's voice wasn't only clothy, it also had a strange choral effect, as if an awful lot of voices were talking at the same time in almost perfect unison. Rincewind pulled himself together.
"Oh, great and wonderful hat," he said pompously. "Strike down this impudent girl who has had the audacity. Nay,
oh, do shut up. She stole us because we ordered her to. It was a near thing, too."
"But she's a..."
Rincewind hesitated.
"She's of the..."
"Female persuasion," he muttered.
"So was your mother."
"Yes, well, but she ran away before I was born," Rincewind mumbled.
"Of all the disreputable taverns in all the city you could have walked into, you walked into his,"
complained the hat.
"He was the only wizard I could find," said the girl. "He looked the part. He had wizard written on his hat and everything." "Don't believe everything you read." "Too late now, anyway. We haven't got much time."
"Hold on, hold on," said Rincewind urgently. "What's going on? You wanted her to steal you? Why haven't we got much time?" He pointed an accusing finger at the hat. "Anyway, you can't go around letting yourself be stolen. You're supposed to be on the Arch-Chancellor's head. The ceremony was tonight. I should have been there. Something terrible is happening at the university. It is vital that we are not taken back, do you understand? You must take us to Clatch, where there is someone fit to wear me."
"Why?"
There was something very strange about the voice, Rincewind decided. It sounded impossible to disobey, as though it was solid destiny. If it told him to walk over a cliff, he thought, he'd be halfway down before it could occur to him to disobey.
"The death of all wizardry is at hand."
Rincewind looked around guiltily.
"Why?"
he said.
"The world is going to end."
"What, again?" said Rincewind.
"I mean it," said the Hat sulkily. "The triumph of the ice giants, the apocalypse, the tea time of the gods, the whole thing."
"Can we stop it?"
"The future is uncertain on that point."
Rincewind's expression of determined terror faded slowly.
"Is this a riddle?" he said.
"Perhaps it would be simpler if you just did what you're told and didn't try to understand things," said the Hat. "Young woman, you will put us back in our box. A great many people will shortly be looking for us."
"Hey, hold on," said Rincewind. "I've seen you around here for years and you've never talked before."
"I didn't have anything that needed to be said."
Rincewind nodded. That seemed reasonable.
"Look, just shove it in its box and let's get going," said the girl.
"A bit more respect, if you please, young lady," said Rincewind haughtily. "That is the symbol of ancient wizardry you happen to be addressing."
"You carry it, then," she said.
"Hey, look," said Rincewind, scrambling along after her as she swept down the alleys, crossed a narrow street and entered another alley between a couple of houses that leaned together so drunkenly that their upper stories actually touched. She stopped.
"Well," she snapped.
"You're the mystery thief, aren't you?" he said. "Everyone's been talking about you, how you've taken things even from locked rooms and everything. You're different than I imagined."
"Oh," she said coldly. "How?"
"Well, you're shorter."
"Oh, come on."
The street cressets, not particularly common in this part of the city in any case, gave out altogether here. There was nothing but watchful darkness ahead.
"I said, come on," she repeated. "What are you afraid of?"
Rincewind took a deep breath.
"Murderers, muggers, thieves, assassins, pickpockets, cutpurses, reavers, snigsmen, rapists and robbers," he said. "That's the shades you're going into."
The Ankh-Morpork Merchants Guild publication Welcome to Ankh-Morpork, City of 1,000 Surprises, describes the area of Old Morpork known as the Shades as a folkloric network of old alleys and picturesque streets where excitement and romance lurks around every corner, and much may be heard the traditional street cries of old time, also the laughing visages of denizens as they go about their business private. In other words, you have been warned.
"Yes, but people won't come looking for us in here," she said.
"Oh, they'll come all right. They just won't come out," said Rincewind. "Nor will we. I mean, a beautiful young woman like you, it doesn't bear thinking about. I mean, some of the people in there..."
"But I'll have you to protect me," she said.
Rincewind thought he heard the sound of marching feet several streets away.
"You know," he sighed, "I knew you'd say that."
Down these mean streets a man must walk, he thought, and along some of them he will break into a run. It is so black in the shades on this foggy spring night that it would be too dark to read about Rincewind's progress through the eerie streets. So the descriptive passage will lift up above the level of the ornate rooftops, the forest of twisty chimneys, and admire the few twinkling stars that manage to pierce the swirling billows. It will try to ignore the sounds drifting up from below, the patter of feet, the rushes, the gristly noises, the groans, the muffled screams. It could be that some wild animal is pacing through the shades after 2 weeks on a starvation diet. Somewhere near the centre of the shades, the district has never been adequately mapped, is a small courtyard. Here, at least, there are torches on the walls, but the light they throw is the light of the shades themselves, mean, reddened, dark at the core. Rincewind staggered into the yard and hung onto the wall for support. The girl stepped into the ruddy light behind him, humming to herself.
"Are you all right?" she said.
"No," said Rincewind.
"Sorry?"
"Those men," he bubbled. "I mean, the way you kicked his... I mean, when you grabbed them by the... when you stabbed the one right in the... Who are you?"
"My name is Kanina."
Rincewind looked at her blankly for some time.
"Sorry," he said.
"Doesn't ring a bell."
"I haven't been here long," she said.
"Yes, I didn't think you were from round these parts," he said. "I would have heard."
"I've taken lodgings here. Shall we go in?"
Rincewind glanced up at the dingy pole just visible in the smoky light of the spitting torches. It indicated that the hostelry behind the small dark door was the Troll's Head. It might be thought that the Mended Drum, scene of unseemly scuffles only an hour ago, was a seedy, disreputable tavern. In fact, it was a reputable, disreputable tavern. Its customers had a certain rough-hewn respectability. They might murder each other in an easy-going way, as between equals, but they didn't do it vindictively. A child could go in for a glass of lemonade and be certain of getting nothing worse than a clip round the ear when his mother heard his expanded vocabulary. On quiet nights, and when he was certain the librarian wasn't going to come in, the landlord was even known to put bowls of peanuts in the bar. The Troll's Head was a cesspit of a different odour. Its customers, if they reformed, tidied themselves up, and generally improved their image out of all recognition, might, just might, aspire to be considered the utter dregs of humanity. And in the shades, a dreg is a dreg. By the way, the thing on the pole isn't a sign. When they decided to call the place the Troll's Head, they didn't mess about. Feeling sick, and clutching the grumbling hatbox to his chest, Rincewind stepped inside. Silence. It wrapped itself around them, nearly as thickly as the smoke of a dozen substances guaranteed to turn any normal brain to cheese. Suspicious eyes peered through the smog. A couple of dice clattered to a halt on a tabletop. They sounded very loud and probably weren't showing Rincewind's lucky number. He was aware of the stares of several score of customers as he followed the demure and surprisingly small figure of Kanina into the room. He looked sideways into the leering faces of men who would kill him sooner than think, and in fact would find it a great deal easier. Where a respectable tavern would have had a bar, there was just a row of squat black bottles and a couple of big barrels on trestles against the wall. The silence tightened like a tourniquet. "Any minute now," Rincewind thought. A big fat man, wearing nothing but a fur vest and a leather loincloth, pushed back his stool and lurched to his feet and winked evilly at his colleagues. When his mouth opened, it was like a hole with a hem.
"Looking for a man, little lady?" he said.
She looked up at him.
"Please keep away."
A snake of laughter writhed around the room. Kanina's mouth snapped shut like a letterbox.
The big man gurgled. "That's right. I likes a girl with spirit."
Kanina's hand moved. It was a pale blur, stopping here and here. After a few seconds of disbelief, the man gave a little grunt and folded up, very slowly. Rincewind shrank back as every other man in the room leaned forward. His instinct was to run, and he knew it was an instinct that would get him instantly killed. It was the shades out there. Whatever was going to happen to him next was going to happen to him here. It was not a reassuring thought. A hand closed around his mouth. Two more grabbed the hatbox from his arms. Kanina spun past him, lifting her skirt to place a neat foot on a target beside Rincewind's waist. Someone whimpered in his ear and collapsed. As the girl pirouetted gracefully around, she picked up two bottles, knocked out their bottoms on the shelf, and landed with their jagged ends held out in front of her. Moorpork daggers, they were called, in the patois of the streets. In the face of them, the Troll's Head clientele lost interest.
"Someone got the hat," Rincewind muttered through dry lips. "They slipped out the back way."
She glared at him and made for the door. The Head's crowd of customers parted automatically, like sharks recognizing another shark, and Rincewind darted anxiously after her before they came to any conclusion about him. They ran out into another alley and pounded down it. Rincewind tried to keep up with the girl. People following her tended to tread on sharp things, and he wasn't sure she'd remember he was on her side, whatever side that was. A thin, half-hearted drizzle was falling, and at the end of the alley was a faint blue glow.
"Wait!"
The terror in Rincewind's voice was enough to slow her down. "What's wrong? Why has he stopped?" "I'll ask him," said Canina firmly. "Why is he covered in snow?" She stopped and turned round, arms thrust into her sides, one foot tapping impatiently on the damp cobbles. "Rincewind, I've known you for an hour, and I'm astonished you've lived even that long." "Yes, but I have, haven't I? I've got a sort of talent for it. Ask anyone. I'm an addict."
"Addicted to what?"
"Life. I got hooked on it at an early age, and I don't want to give it up. And take it from me, this doesn't look right." Canina looked back at the figure, surrounded by the glowing blue aura. It seemed to be looking at something in its hands. Snow was settling on its shoulder like really bad dandruff, terminal dandruff. Rincewind had an instinct for these things, and he had a deep suspicion that the man had gone where shampoo would be no help at all. They sidled along a glistening wall. "There's something very strange about him," she conceded.
"You mean the way he's got his own private blizzard?"
"Doesn't seem to upset him. He's smiling."
"A frozen grin, I'd call it."
The man's icicle-hung hands had been taking the lid off the box, and the glow from the hat's octarines shone up into a pair of greedy eyes that were already heavily rimed with frost.
"Know him?" said Canina.
Rincewind shrugged.
"I've seen him around," he said.
"He's called Larry the Fox, or Fezzy the Stoat, or something. Some sort of rodent, anyway. Just steals things. He's harmless."
"He looks incredibly cold,"
Canina shivered. "I expect he's gone to a warmer place. Don't you think we should shut the box?"
"It's perfectly safe now," said the hat's voice from inside the glow. "And so perish all enemies of wizardry."
Rincewind wasn't about to trust what a hat said.
"We need something to shut the lid," he muttered. "A knife or something. You wouldn't have one, would you?"
"Look the other way," Canina warned. There was a rustle and another gust of perfume. "You can look back now." Rincewind was handed a 12-inch throwing knife. He took it gingerly. Little particles of metal glinted on its edge. "Thanks," he turned back. "Not leaving you short, am I?"
"I have others."
"I'll bet." Rincewind reached out gingerly with the knife. As it neared the leather box, its blade went white and started to steam. He whimpered a little as the cold struck his hand. A burning, stabbing cold, a cold that crept up his arm and made a determined assault on his mind. He forced his numb fingers into action, and with great effort nudged the edge of the lid with the tip of the blade. The glow faded. The snow became sleet, then melted into drizzle. Canina nudged him aside and pulled the box out from the frozen arms.
"I wish there was something we could do for him. It seems wrong to just leave him here."
"He won't mind," said Rincewind with conviction.
"Yes, but we could at least lean him against the wall or something."
Rincewind nodded and grabbed the frozen thief by his icicle arm. The man slipped out of his grasp and hit the cobbles, where he shattered. Canina looked at the pieces.
"Ugh," she said.
There was a disturbance further up the alley, coming from the back door of the troll's head. Rincewind felt the knife snatched from his hand and then go past his ear in a flat trajectory that ended in the doorpost 20 yards away. A head that had been sticking out withdrew hurriedly.
"We'd better go," said Canina, hurrying along the alley. "Is there somewhere we can hide? Your place?"
"I generally sleep at the university," said Rincewind, hopping along behind her.
"You must not return to the university,"
growled the hat from the depths of its box. Rincewind nodded distractedly. The idea certainly didn't seem attractive.
"Anyway, they won't allow women inside after dark," he said.
"And before dark?"
"Not then either."
Canina sighed.
"That's silly. What have you wizards got against women, then?"
Rincewind's brow wrinkled. "We're not supposed to put anything against women," he said. "That's the whole point